Nice to get a Sharpie a fortnight's relief. Always look forward and hope for good weather on the relief day so the boat could get out and pick you up. Because if the weather was too bad, you lost time. If the weather was bad and the boat couldn't get out, of course, you had to do extra days. But it had its repercussions because the man ashore, he had extra time ashore. So it was like swings and roundabouts. Sometimes you won, sometimes you lost. But as I say, it was always nice to get ashore and back home to Nina and the young one. And Nina had settled in quite good in Stromness. People were very friendly. She got to know quite a few people, and so did I, of course. There was, we used to go down shopping down the main street. She used to do all the, get all the groceries from a store there named, called Wilson's. Big fat man he was, and there was a very nice girl assistant in the shop. Her name was Pearl. She became a very good friend to us there. She used to babysit occasionally for us. Pearl, I forget her second name, but she was a very, very nice girl. And then there was Stock and the Bakers. There was an electrician shop there. I used to get bits and pieces from Merriman's. And they're still there, I believe. But Pearl used to call in to occasionally, and as I say, babysit. And then Walter, the taxi driver, he used to come and visit us. Then at the side of our house there, there was a lane going up to a isolated cottage right at the top, and there's a man and woman named Fisher lived there, and they got very friendly. This Mr. Fisher, he was working for the builder. I think the builder's name was Harvey, who built the lighthouse houses. He was a joiner, so he'd done a few odd jobs for us, and his wife was extremely nice. She always called in to have a chat with Nina. And then Nina became pregnant again, and our second daughter, Leslie, she was born there in 1952. And Mrs. Fisher was very, very handy and useful to Nina at that time. So it was nice. We got to know them all. And then, of course, there were the keepers at the other stations. I can't recall all their names, but at the Copensea station, the principal's keeper name was Renbow. He was an Arcadian. And then there was a couple we got extremely friendly with, the Mansons. They belonged to Caithness, Northern Scotland. He was a little chap, very nice. His wife was quite a hefty, very, very jolly woman. She was nearly always in our house. They had no family. Jessie Manson. She was a very good friend to Nina. And then there was an English chap and his wife, Freeman, I think his name was, if I recall it. But we didn't have a lot to do with them. And then at the Oscary station, there was an old chap, he was near retiring age. Matheson, his name was the principal keeper. And then there was a chap, a massive, big, tall bloke. He came from the Isle of Skye, John Nicholson. But his wife was from Yorkshire, a little tiny woman, a little plump woman she was. I forget what part of Yorkshire, but she was broad Yorkshire. Mavis, her name was. And she used to be in our house a lot too. She had a couple of children. Just forget the names that they called the youngster. It was a peculiar name, a Gaelic name. And another family at Oscary was a chap called Stuart Thompson. A very nice bloke. They were from the Shetland Islands, him and his wife. And his wife used to come in to visit Nina too. She was an extremely good, well, she was a famous knitter. We've seen it since we came retired and come back to the Isle of Man to live on television. She was the fastest knitter, hand knitter in the world. It was fantastic. She used to come in and talk, they'd be talking to Nina, and Nina'd be plodding away with her knitting. But this Annie Thompson, she wore a belt, I believe it's the thing for the people up in Shetland who knit. And fitted onto this belt was like a big pin cushion. And with the left hand, they stuck the one knitting needle into this pin cushion, and then the other two hands worked all the different colours in the knit, making these Shetland sweaters and Fair Isle patterns. And I used to be sitting there, either listening to the radio or reading, and I was amazed because it was like a machine. You could see her knitting growing and growing as you sat watching her. And she'd be talking away to Nina. It was all automatic to her. But we saw, as I say, we've seen her twice on television, once when we lived in Manchester, demonstrating this style of knitting. And Stuart played the pipes. On New Year's Eve, they used to put the radio telephone on and all the stations got in touch with each other. And Stuart would play the pipes at midnight. Well, he left the service and he went back to, they went back to Shetland. And Walter Hancock, I've mentioned, keeps in touch with us. He'd been in touch with them too, and he said that Stuart was one of the number one men up there. He had quite a good job, something to do with the airport, and he was a postmaster. He had about four or five different jobs after he left the service, all at the same time. I'd love to get in touch with him again. And Mr. Fisher, who lived up the lane from us, he played the pipes, and he used to practice at night, every evening, in the summer, from the house. You could hear him walking up and down outside his cottage at the top of the lane. You could hear the pipes. Lovely sound, and especially in those settings. Now, the cinema was held, I'm not sure it was on a Thursday night or a Saturday night, in the town hall. There was no proper cinema. It was just in the town hall. And they had dances and socials there, but the cinema was, I'm almost sure it was Saturday night. And there were no proper seats, there were wooden benches. And the films were all ancient. We'd seen most of them. But it was an event, and it was well attended. So we used to go when we could. The doctor was a drunk. Every now and again he had to go away to be dried out. It began with T, his name, I forget now. Not Tullock. But an extremely nice man, very, very quiet. But apparently he used to hit the bottle and become a drunk. Now so did the dentist, I forget his name too. Now he was a little chubby bloke, and he had a little house on the main street in Stromness. And we had to, well, it was on the way down to the shops, and we used to have to pass his house as we were going to the shops. Then coming back, there was a window facing you as you walked back up the street. He was often there, you'd see him. He'd half net curtains halfway up the window, and they were absolutely filthy. And Willie, something his name was, you'd see him there in his white jacket. He always had a big grin on his face and he'd give you a wave. At first I used to think, oh, he's doing something, you know, with the job. Then he'd hold a fish up and wave a fish at you. He'd been struck off the register by the NHS. Apparently some woman had gone in have an extraction, and he'd got her in the chair and sat her down and got her all in ready, and And then he picked his forceps up off a tray, and the last customer's tooth was stuck on the forceps. And he just knocked the tooth off and went to put them in her mouth. And she got up and said no, and she reported him. There was a bit of an inquiry, and he was struck off. So he just done private. But they say he was a dental surgeon. And I was told that the nearest dentist at that time then was in Kirkwall. And I believe when they had a very bad case of anything like that from the mouth in Kirkwall, they used to ask him then as an advisor. He wasn't allowed to treat them, but he used to go and give advice what to do. It was a shame, an awful shame, because he had the plate outside his house there with all the letters behind his name, Edinburgh. He'd passed his certificates, a load of letters behind his name. What a tragedy. I believe he's always had a pair of forceps in his top pocket of his jacket. He was always in and out of the pub. If somebody in the pub, you know, said, oh, I'll have to come and see you, will he? Take this tooth out for me. He said, oh, it's all right. Open your mouth, I'll pull it out here. Real characters. There was a little sandy beach there too where we used to take the children down. It wasn't a big beach, it was only a little tiny place. Very tiny, but it was quite nice. And as I say, the place was such a quiet, peaceful place. It was beautiful. The only thing was, it was so far from the Isle of Man when we to go on holidays. I'm not sure that we came home on holidays once during the time we were up there, but we said we'd never do it again. My sister Winnie came up to visit us there once too. She came up after Leslie was born. She made the journey, and we used to say, oh, once we get away from here, we'll never come back, it's too far away, too far away. But we've been twice since. And if my legs were in better shape now, and I didn't have this arthritis, I'd like another trip up there. Just after we'd moved in there, the first family to come ashore off the rock, the Duffys, that was their name, the Duffys. They left the service and they went back home to Rothsay, that's it, on the Firth of Clyde, on the Clyde. So they left, and a young single chap joined the service and moved in. Sinclair Craigie. He'd served his time as a joiner. He belonged to Orkney. I just forget what parts there. Not far from Kirkwall, I think it was, but Sinclair, he, a nice young lad, pleasant young lad, and after he'd been there a while, he got married. Now, Jimmy Sinclair, the first assistant, he was single too, but I'm not sure whether he got in touch with a woman by Contact magazine or something. He was a very, very shy chap. Anyway, he married this woman from Fifeshire. And she moved in. She was a great big horsey type of woman. Very, very pleasant. She always reminded me of a comedian at the time, Joyce Grenfell. Her parents had a chemist shop in a hometown. I can't call the hometown, but I know it was Fifeshire. And then later they had a child. They called it, well, just forget now, Morag, I think it was called. Morag, another Celtic name. And she was getting great big parcels and nappies and things from her parents. She had a kitchen. We used to go down to see them, and their kitchen was like a chemist's shop. They're a lovely couple, lovely couple. Anyway, out on the rock, things were going all right. This boat, Jimmy Sinclair, finished this boat he built. And then one day he said, oh, we'll give it a Viking funeral. Made a beautiful boat. But because there was no way of getting it ashore, he'd put the time in, so made a makeshift sail on it and set fire to it and set it off down the Firth like a Viking's funeral. But Munro was the most peculiar guy, the principal keeper. He had a grown-up daughter, she'd be about 22 or 23, and she used to visit them. And when he was ashore, when she visited, the locals have told me, and Nina, they used to always laugh at them. They used to hold hands and dance all the way down the main street, all the way home. Oh, he was most peculiar. And out on the rock after dinner every day went for a walk around. Well, we all of us used to go for a walk, but nobody would go with him. He used to get a handkerchief out and he'd pull it corner to corner and stretch it and tuck it, just a corner of it, into his back pocket of his trousers with almost the whole handkerchief trailing like a tail. And he used to walk around. I said, what do you do that for? He says, so that I can be seen. No, they used to go for a walk with this trailing. And as I mentioned about hobbies, well, he'd done nothing else but made clothes pegs. Now, we had all sorts of machines and tools out there, and he used to make these clothes pegs on a lathe. And he used to use calipers and measure them to within a thousandth of an inch. And he made, they were really works of art, I would say, clothes pegs, every one identical. And he had a fisherman's basket, and he used to throw them, make them and throw them in the basket. And he'd spend months and months, must have made thousands and thousands. And when the basket was full, he used to carry it to the edge of the rock and throw them all in the sea. I didn't like asking him why he'd done it. But he was the most peculiar guy. He's supposed to be very religious. He used to spend his leave, like going to some, get the aisle where one of the monks went. But he told me, he was ashore one time, and he told Nina she wasn't to hang washing out on the clothesline out in the garden on a Sunday, because it wasn't in keeping with the station, it was anti-religious. So she told him what to do. And when she told me, I got on him and all. And he made the remark again about, you Sassenach. So I said, I may be a Sassenach, I said, but I've got a hometown. I was brought up in the one place. I said, you're just like a gypsy. You haven't got a hometown. So he never brought the subject of Sassenach up again. But we, as I say, we had no television or radio then, and Lord Nuffield, he was the head of what was then the British Motor Corporation, made Morrison, Austin cars. He supplied a battery radio to all these outlandish lighthouses, rock stations. A lovely radio, but of course you had to buy your own batteries. There was no, we had no electricity there, it was oil lamps and that. So we had got this radio, and he was always putting discussions on. If you put some dance music on or a variety show, he would switch it off. And Jimmy Sinclair had left the service, he'd got transferred, and he was replaced by a man called Bill Ord. He came from the east coast of Scotland, Methil, I think it was, and he peculiar to him. He had a way of speaking. Yeah, I'm just going for a wee walkie down the roadie. And everything ended at E. Well, he liked listening to sport. So when Monroe started turning his sports programs off and that, this Billard, we all subscribed to the batteries. Billard said, well, I'm not paying for you to listen to religious programs and just what you want. And Sinclair Craigie has said the same. He said, I'm not paying if I can't listen to what I want. So I said, well, that's the same. So nobody would pay for the batteries. So the radio was there. Bill Ord bought one himself, and I bought one at Merriman's when I came ashore, a battery portable. So in the finish, everybody had their own radios. That was Monroe. In the summertime, there was a fishing boat used to come around and fish lobsters and crabs around our little island. It came from the island of Stromer, which also had a lighthouse on. Actually, from our station, there were quite a few lights to watch. We had to report them every night and enter in the log whether they were visible from our station. There was Dunnet Head on the mainland of Scotland, near Wick, and then Stromer, then us, and then further up north was Copensay and Oscary. And as I say, the sightings had to be noted in the log every hour. So Stromer, this little island there, it was quite a big island, and there was a few people living there at the time. Apparently at one time there'd been quite a few people there. But this chap who came out with the boat, he ran the general store and post office on the island. They called him Crooked John. Now, he just looked like a pirate. He had one leg, it was amputated a bit above the knee. And he had one eye, and he wore a black patch over his eye. And he had an old dirty peaked cap. And all the years, the 4 years I was there, he always had about 3 or 4 weeks of growth. Not a beard, but a long, heavy, thick growth. Crooked John, they said he was, they called him. And he had a truck, the only vehicle on the island of Stromer. And his was the only boat there. So if you had a little farm on Stromer, a croft, and you wanted to go ashore, you had to be friendly with Crooked John, because that's the only way you could get off the island, was on his boat. But he was a peculiar chap, and there was another young bloke come with him, the two of them in the boat. But this Crooked John, and he had a homemade crutch. He'd made it himself, but he could hobble about this boat and jump about in it with this one leg. And he used to sit in the stern there, holding the rudder steering. And they were good friends to us. And he used to tell us some awful tales. John never spoke. He used to speak to him. And I said, it's a nice day, John. And I said, Hawkeye, Hawkeye. That's all we used to get out of him. Laugh, he would never speak. But the other lad, you know, I was talking to him about Stromer, you know, with the many people there. And he was saying, oh no, but at one time there used to be quite a few people there. So, he was saying what life was there like there. Now he told me, this is the gospel truth, he said when anybody died there, the graves were only one deep. If someone died, if your mother died, you buried her. And if your father died, you dug the mother up and threw her in the sea and buried the father. He swore this was true. And I said, oh, come up at you. You're pulling my leg. But he said, no, he says, you think, he said, over all the years and the centuries, and the people that have died there, he said, if they hadn't done that, if that wasn't the tradition on Stroma, he said, the island would be one big cemetery. There wouldn't be any room to farm or anything. So he swore that was the truth. Whether it was or not, I don't know. But I've often thought that, you know, there was logic in what he said. It would have ended up just being one cemetery. Remember, these are small islands. Now, we used to, I used to write letters, and so did the others, and we used to give them to John, and they used to post them when they got back home to Stroma. And Nina used to, and the other lads, their wives, used to do a little bit of baking, or buy something in the grocers and make a small parcel up and send them to Stroma. And John brought them out. And it used to help us out, give a bit of variety of what to eat during the relief. So these men, they were very, very good to us. I always liked them. They were wonderful men, I thought. And then occasionally they used to give us a lobster or a crab. Now, then one time, they gave us a lobster, beautiful lobster. I used to love crab and lobster. Anyway, we got this lobster off from this day, and we had it for, at lunchtime. So, after lunch, I had a cigarette, and sit down for a while, and then I went for a walk around the island. The weather had got up, and it was quite rough. I used to love going around watching the waves crashing over me. So as I was walking around the island, I started getting itchy. My face, my chest, scratching myself. And as I got further around, like swelling. By the time I got back to the lighthouse, I could hardly open my fingers. So the lad said, what the hell's the matter with you? I was covered in like sores, boils coming up. My eyes were half closed and my body had swelled and I couldn't close or open my hands anymore. I was covered in these. So they had to radio ashore. So asked for a doctor to come out. But by the time the doctor got down to Willie Budge's house to come out, the weather had deteriorated and the boat couldn't come out. So they had to take over me watch. I couldn't keep me watch. Anyway, during the night, I vomited something terrible. I had terrible diarrhea. I was hours on the toilet. And next morning, I was absolutely sweating and sick. So they brought the boat out the next day. The weather had improved and the boat came out with the doctor, and he examined me and that, and he said, well, you know what it is? And I said, no. He said, shellfish poisoning. He said, if you hadn't have been so sick and had the diarrhea from the night, he said, you wouldn't have lasted till morning, you'd have been dead. He said, you're lucky, very lucky indeed. So I said, well, if it's shellfish poison, I said, we all had it, the three of us. So he said, well, it only needs, he says, it's only a small thing of it, size of the head of a pin. That's what it is, he said. And you were unfortunate, you caught, you had it. It won't really frighten me, I thought I was going to die. No, I've never had shellfish since, that was in 1952 then. I've never had shellfish then, since then. And I loved it. I always had it as a child. My father was always getting crabs and making crab salad. And that was it. Once a year, the flagship, the Hesperus, used to go around visiting all the stations with all the commissioners of the Northern Lighthouse Board. on board, and they used to come and inspect every station. So everything had to be spick and span and polished up and dressed in the number one uniforms and all that. They came ashore and checked over everything, shook everybody's hand and all that. It happened once a year. And a funny thing that I always remember there, apparently the lighthouse keeper, the principal keeper on the island of Stroma, where the fishermen come from, it was the fishermen that told us. Now, in every station, you have a list telling you what time the light has to go on every day and what time it has to be put out in the morning. That has to be strictly adhered to. Now, when the commissioners went ashore at Stroma, the head commissioner said to the principal keeper, "Oh, mister, I forget his name now," he said, "it's been reported that your light is always the last to go on at night. You're always the last one to light up at night." And the principal keeper said to him, "Oh, yes, sir, that may be so, sir. But we're always first out in the morning." I always laugh when I remember that. I believe the head commissioner just looked at him and shook his head and walked away, because apparently he was quite a character, this chap. Now, once a year we had to paint the lighthouses down to, from top to bottom. Now, first of all, we had to paint the dome, that's the bit on top of the light room. Now, there's only one ladder up it, and the other, to get right round it, there's only hand grips. So you had to get up this little ladder straight to the top, and then stretch out, and they're just big enough to put your foot on, or get hold of, and work round to the furthest point out, and then paint your way back. It was black, painted black, and the weather vane too on top, which is a very, very awkward thing to ease your way back with a paint pot and a brush in. And you had to lift the shape of it as a dome, like half a ball, of course. One little slip and you would fall down about 100 foot and crash onto the concrete at the bottom. So two men used to go up and work their way out opposite sides and worked your way back. I was up doing this with Willie Ord. Now, this Willie Ord, apparently he'd had a nervous breakdown a few years previously. And his hands used to shake. If he was using a screwdriver to screw something, he couldn't do it. He used to say, "Well, could you screw this for me? Because his hands just used to shake." Well, he got up and he got out there. And I started painting coming back. And he couldn't move. He was petrified. I said, "Come on, Bill, come on." He was shaking like a leaf and a sweat pouring off. I can't move. So in the finish, I had to shout down. Young Sinclair Craig, he was the other man on watch. He was his turn on cooking. So I asked him to come up and bring a rope up. I shouted to him, "Bring a stick or something." So he come up and two of us went out and we tied the rope round Billy Ord, but he wouldn't let go. We both held onto this rope, so we had to go and get a stick and tap his hands until he let go. And then we took the weight, we had the rope threaded through one of these grips so that if he slipped, he wouldn't fall. That's what he'd done, he slipped, so we had to gently ease him down over the light room and down onto the balcony. He was in a terrible state. Well, then, you have to paint the white down from the balcony. That's just by the light room. It's done by a staging. About two planks width and two arms on it with wheels on. And at each side there's what you call a cleat. like a piece of metal. And the rope threads through, and then when you get to the position where you want, you thread the rope around this, what they're called cleats, this T-junction, to hold you safe. Now, it was quite these plankings, or stagings is the proper name, were slightly curved to this run of the light, of the lighthouse wall. As I say, they had wheels on the end for easy lowering down. Well, in the middle was a tank, a metal tank, full of lime wash. You mix the lime a week or two before, water, bins of water, and then powdered lime you put in and stirred, and you leave it a week or two to thicken. So this was then put into this tank, and we had two poles with round brushes. They usually call them Turk's heads. These round brushes on, and you had to man each side of the tank, and you put your brush in and reached as far as you could and painted it down. When you'd done that stretch, you had to undo the ropes. You had to be careful. One slip and you'd both be on the ground, and do it in unison and gently lower it and put the cleat on, put the rope around the cleat again. Well, Billy Ord, he started being the same way. He wouldn't lower down. He'd be having it, when I started to lower, we'd go on a bit of an angle. So we had a hell of a job that time. When I'd done the one strip down, I said, "Oh, I'm not going up anymore with him." So he said, Willie Ord said, "Well, I'll do the cooking." And he asked young Sinclair Craigie, and Sinclair went up with me and we done it. But it was a hair-raising experience. But he was terrible nervous, terrible. Another day I remember Willie Ord. It was very, very foggy, thick fog. And we had our dinner, and we had the fog on going, and Sinclair Craig, he says, "Oh, I'm going for a walk around, are you coming, Arthur?" So I said, "Yes, okay." So we set up, and we got part way around, and I was rolling my own cigarettes then, rolling my tobacco, and I said, "Oh, I'm going to make a cigarette." So we sat on the rocks, and I got my tobacco tin out, and I was just rolling this cigarette, and I could hear noise of ship's engine. And I said to Sinclair Craigie, "There's a ship somewhere here." He says, "Where?" I said, "Quiet, quiet." Then he says, "Oh yeah, you could hear it throbbing." I said, "My God, she's close." So we were still sitting there on the rocks, and all of a sudden, a great big bow of a ship came right up in front of us. Not more than, what can I say, 10, 12 feet in front of us, this big bow of a ship crashed onto the rock. So a man commented over the bow, over the rails at the bow, and he said in a broad American voice, "What lump of shit is this?" Our hearts were pounded, you know. So I said, "It's the Pentland Skerries." So I said, "We'll go and report you to the ground." So, what's the name of the ship? I just forget now. It was an American Indian name. So I said to Sinclair, "You stand by here, Sinclair, and I'll go up and tell Bill." So I went back to the station and I told Bill Ord. I says, "Bill, there's a ship aground here." I told him the name. He says, "Yes, you, it's not a joke. It's not a joke. You're kidding me, aren't you?" I said, "No. No, I'm not, Bill. You'll have to report it." So he said, "Well, I'm not reporting anything till I see it." So I brought him to, "Well, come and see yourself then." So he had a look, and then he said, "Oh, yes, yes." So we rushed back, and I went with him, and he got on the radio, to the radio set, and he plugged in, Lucy. Pentland Skerry's here. Pentland Skerry's here. There's a ship. There's a ship and it's up on the rocks. Oh, it's a big one. It's an American ship. I said, who are you talking to? He said, I'm reporting it. I'm reporting it. I said, who to? I said, you'd better make an identity and plug it in and call Wick Radio first. So he said, oh, you do it then. So I took on and I had to report it. It stayed there overnight, and then next day it cleared up, and the Langhope lifeboat came out and stood by, and there was another, what you call it, boat coming, little boat wanting to know if you wanted to tow. But with the high tide, they managed to slide it off, run it off in the high tide, and they went into Kirkwall to have the damage checked. Wasn't badly damaged. Always remember that. Oh yes, it's a queer job, a lighthouse keeper. As I've said before, the duties of a lighthouse keeper were primarily to keep the light and fog on signalling in perfect working order. And then during the day, the station had to be kept to perfection, you know, with the brass being cleaned every day and the engines polished and the floors and the walls scrupulously clean. You never know when you might get a surprise visit from the commissioners. I know they came once a year, but occasionally there were surprise visits. And a good lighthouse keeper, he had to have or acquire the temperament necessary for the job, which involved close residence to the sea and often in isolated places. As I've said, with the likes of Willie Audius, I was surprised at him there. And you had to possess or acquire a good working knowledge of engines so that you could start the engines whenever the fog descended and in order to operate them. And at all times you had to study the sea and learn to respect its immense power. Then in addition, you had to be a handyman to a reasonably high standard, be a good cook, and above all, a good companion. Because living on a rock in the middle of the sea with two other men for periods of up to 2 months could be difficult, and so unequal to temperament was essential. So that's why I mentioned about Munro and Willie Horn. I don't think they were the type needed for the service. And then, as I said before, most men had hobbies which they were able to do while they were cut off from civilization. Many became experts at woodwork, sewing, cooking and painting. The Northern Lighthouse Service used to have a waiting list of applicants wanting to join, but now computers have taken over all the stations. It was said a lightkeeper would never be rich, but the odds were he would be at peace with himself and the world. How true that was. And so it was, after 4 years, nearly 4.5 years there, got where it was time, that was the normal or the usual spell of duty, 4 years at the station. I was due for a transfer. So I inquired if there was any vacancy in the stations in the Isle of Man. He's on the Isle of Man, there's Douglas Head Lighthouse, Langness Lighthouse, the Chickens Rock Lighthouse, and the Point of Ayre. Well, normally, the normal run of things was that you used to do a spell at the shore station and then a spell at the rock station. So I thought perhaps I'd get Douglas Head or Langness or the Point of Ayre. Anyway, the word came back that there were quite a few men ill at the time, couldn't do a rock station, so I was being transferred to the Chickens Rock, which was a damn sight worse rock station than the Pentland Skerry's. Anyway, it was in the Isle of Man. So the time came to leave, and we got packed up, and Walter came with his taxi to take us down to the boat with all our things, and we set off down the main street, and people turned out in the main street to wave goodbye. It was amazing. When we come to Wilson's grocery shop, Mr. Wilson came out and he stopped the taxi, and he had a box of chocolates for Nina and some sweets for the kiddies. And there was another little shop there, stopped, and I think they gave a doll to one of the kiddies. And the little tobacconist shop, there was an old woman used to have, I used to buy all my tobacco. She came out and gave me a tin of tobacco and papers. What wonderful people, wonderful people. I've never met people like that in my life. I think they're marvellous people, the Arcadians, or they were then anyway. So we got on the new St. Olaf. It was a different boat we were leaving on, with a nice cabin, and we set sail for Scrabster. Got the train at Thurso, and then we went all the way down on that slow train again to Glasgow, and then from there we got the boat to Liverpool, and from there to the Isle of Man, and down to Port St. Mary, where the shore station for the Chicken's Rock is situated. There was a block of four flats, two up and two down. So we moved into the upstairs, one of the upstairs flats there at the lighthouse station at Port St. Mary. And it wasn't long before I got word I had to go out to a terrible place, the Chicken's Rock. It's just a solid rock under the sea. The rock is only visible at